Yes, thank you so much for this, if I may say, both arresting and moving talks. Since we are a bit over time, I'd suggest that we might, if there should be any questions already in the audience, we might open up the floor right away. There's a question. Francesco, okay.
I would have a question for Catherine. I also discovered that that Harvard Educational Review magazine, when I was doing my research a few years back, and I also wrote an essay then that started off from a comparative reading of Woods's article and De Carlo's article that share quite a lot in their argument, somehow exactly arguing that the city is the school and all of that. Then my interest was then to look at how the architects within themselves emerged out of that discussion, and so how did they move from text to drawing and to building somehow. So I compared also some of their buildings, and in particular the fact that both of them took part to the same competition more or less a few years back for a university in Dublin. So I compared those two. And I also compared the way in which the two articles were illustrated. If you looked at it, De Carlo is illustrating his article only with photographs of students. Students protesting in 1968, but also students understood in a very traditional way. Whereas Woods is illustrating it with his own drawings of his own projects, and particularly with the famous Berlin Free University diagram. So I just wanted to know what is your opinion, let's say, about how they operated as architects, how they translated those ideas of walking somehow. Within their own projects, in particular, maybe with relation to the very celebrated then Berlin Free University.
Well, I don't know. Is the answer to that? I'm not an architect historian. I don't follow the work of architects in that sense. What I was really interested in that publication that came out in 1969 was, first of all, the Harvard Educational Review being interested enough to commission the best radical architects, as they saw them, in the world at that point, to bring them together to produce a publication. And as a historian, more a historian of childhood and education, I'm not so much interested in what they went on to, I am interested in their buildings to some extent, but I was more interested in that moment of confabulation or bringing together of ideas with a kind of optimism, well, more than optimism, with an energy which felt unstoppable. And I'm much more interested in trying to make sense of that than, I'm sorry, of the history of the arc, the buildings that they went on to produce.
Okay. Yeah, no, maybe because just the question would have ended with, you ended up with Woods's argument that we should stop building schools somehow, that is also your argument, and we should see the city as a school, but then, of course, They ended up designing schools.
I work with architects who build schools, and I think, schools are not terrible places. But we have got a problem that we have a very strong set idea about what a school is and what its possibilities are. So going back to that email that I received, it's so limited. When we think what technology we have today, when we think of the possibilities of learning and living and doing things differently, when we think of the challenges that we have today, to enable young people to learn how to live together, not just to learn together. It seems to me an urgent question: can we stop building schools?
Do you think we could switch some of these?
Yes, I would also prefer having not. But it's for the
But if we put the lights back on, then we could see your faces. Yeah.
when you ask the question.
Is this a hand? No. Yes, thank you. Any more questions? Yes, there's one. Michael Beers.
Yes, thanks for both of your interesting talks. And I have a question for each of you in response to what you, to your talks. And maybe I'll start with Evan. I mean, where you ended with this kind of hardened, spoke to me about the current discussion in the US around school safety and especially hardening perimeters, so that keeping the danger out of the school, which can easily translate to keeping the danger in the school controlled, and made me think about, for instance, some of the state schools that were built in the early 1970s in the States, like in particular Humboldt, Cal State Humboldt, which was specifically designed to control possible student riots. So, and this kind of led me to think about, for instance, films like Over the Edge, or the People Next Door films from beginning of the 70s and the end of the 70s, which are explicitly about kind of student unrest and social enemy. So I wonder if you could somehow, keeping this kind of lineage of the social imaginary of school defensibility, speak to what you see in the kind of current climate around possibilities for reimagining the school as maybe an indefensible space, if you will. And then, Catherine, if I can maybe more briefly, just what I was thinking about with your talk was like a lot of the articles I've read by Will Self, with his perambulations like this, it's so that he kind of has reimagined situationist practice as kind of marathon walking sessions. And I wonder then, though, the importance of feet, if we don't need the school, maybe the school is just a kind of mobile classroom that could be kind of transiting the countryside, and that this may be coming from, I don't know if in the UK, like these wild kindergartens, like forest kindergartens, are a thing, but if there's what kind of possibility there would be for simply not having a school, but having a kind of mobile classroom.
Shall I briefly say something? I don't know Will Self's work. Sorry. Did you say Will Self?
Yes, Will Self.
He's written about walking.
A lot.
Oh, I should go and read him then. Yeah, mobile buses, classrooms, things that move around. I mentioned Tim Ingold, the anthropologist, and his argument is that we've lost something precious and important about which is a kind of knowledge that we get through the sensitivity of feet touching the ground. And of course, he talks about earlier sorts of societies where that was very common. Of course, in parts of the world today, that is the way that we touch the ground, through bare feet. And so it's a particular kind of sensitivity that I'm interested in. Not just mobility, but that kind of touch, that knowledge, that particular kind of knowledge, perhaps that we need to return to in this digital age of machinery and so on. But there's also something else, which is when you walk with rhythm. And rhythm, rhythmic movement, is also quite interesting in relation to thinking and sorting things out. And there's a whole world of work there to be done on the history of rhythm and rocking and movement in the school. So, Will Self, thank you.
And thanks for the question. I mean, excuse me, one of the things I sort of skipped over but that's relevant for the question of Humboldt is the sort of the other side of that technique, which is also where I did my PhD at Santa Cruz, which in many ways represents a kind of defensive architecture via atomization. So, right, it was sort of master plan for that designed in 63, built 1 year before free speech movement explodes at Berkeley in 64. Kerr is very explicit about the involvement, but basically, you know, for those who haven't been there, it's very beautiful if you do, but it's sort of radically spread out. It's the place where Jean Baudrillard kind of famously is like, how could you have a demonstration here? You just march back and forth under the trees speaking to no one. Now, you know, this is the thing we practically answered by occupying buildings and a whole number of kind of complicated things, but I raise that because I think that what I'm sort of trying to get towards is to think about the simultaneity and in some sense a relative for a while, these kind of triumph of forms of neutralization that can pass under the sign of, you know, the chance to freely roam, but in many ways are also designed to lack a point of visible collectivity. There's no central gathering point. I'd raise that also because of the question of contemporary securitization, and particularly around things like school shootings, is there's a pretty drastic transformation from a civil society organized around the threat of organized collectives, potentially kind of radical militant collectives, versus the figure of the quote-unquote lone wolf, even if, as we know, they often issue from ethnic nationalist communities, et cetera, white nationalists specifically, obviously. But there is something really drastic for me in that transformation from a energy of and or fear towards kind of collective organization as opposed to sort of fragmentary, inchoate, individual violence. And I think, you know, because you raised the question of also kind of popular film, which is a major question of mine. I mean, I would say, and I've written a bit on this, that if you track something weirdly like the genre of undead films, of zombie films, you can see in really dramatic way the shift away from an image of a sort of all together now, the dead rise, towards an image of kind of blamable contagion, a one-to-one logic. So that's the tricky thing right now, is there's one is facing forms of increasingly literally militarized architecture, but that are predicated on the fantasy of the one who goes bad, in some regard. So it's a fundamental drift in some sense, I think, from the operative forms of control at work in this period, which I think, you know, so I'd suggest that version of landscaping I'm talking about is also production of a kind of what will eventually be recognizable as an entrepreneurial figure, passes through concrete channels, but does so under the sign of self-exploitation, or something like that.
There's another question.
Hey, thank you for your talk. I coming from dance and body-based practices, there was something that you referred to with this walk. There is an element of addressing the bodies with the which was a lot discussed in the other talks related to the architecture and the space that is outside of it. But in your talk, Catherine, there was a clear...
Can you put your microphone?
Yeah, there was a clear... there is a clear pointing toward the body, like how the body is addressed in this. And I just... I think, I don't know if it's more of a comment or more of a... Because we talked about the school and how can we not build more schools. Well, this is also very relative in where we are, because there are places who are, there's a lot of advocacy that we need, like they need this space to be a space of hospitality or for that, we need that host space to be able to first host something and then we can revise what it is going to do. I'm just yet how, like, maybe the question more goes on to this, like, how the beyond the architectural aspect, how would you consider the, like, the entry point to thinking about how do we address bodies in education spaces?
The entry point.
Yeah.
I think I would say to that, what is the entry point in thinking about addressing bodies in education? It's quite an interesting question, and I've been thinking about it over the past couple of days, you know, stimulated by this gathering here. I think the entry point has to shift much more towards politics and living relationships. And if it's almost impossible to imagine this, but to pull away from pedagogic, cognitive, psychology, educational thinking, because the body is crucial in making choices, in moving, placing itself in relation to others. And relationships are at the heart of democracy and democratic living and civilized living. So education is framed by the rise of psychology and the rise of cognitive psychology and the rise of the educational professional. I'm one of them, I'm an educationalist. But as a historian, I'm aware that at a certain conjecture, a certain point in the post-war world, just after the end of the Second World War, there was a real sense that schools were places for the promotion and development and the growing of good living together. And that is a political project. And so the entry point for me in relation to the body in movement, the body making choice, the body making relationships with others, is more a political framework than a scientific framework, if you like, if you see pedagogy as science. And this is just fresh in my mind. And I know it's provocative and impossible to think about, but I think we could do with thinking the impossible, especially in places like this where, you know, we're encouraged to think beyond the box. Do you want to say anything to that?
I have a question more about that we had raised the other day about... No, it was actually something that I'd love to ask you about that Tom and I were speaking about the other day, and might be a question that you don't have answer to, but I certainly don't. Would also be to think about, I'd be curious to think about how educational architecture has transformed in relation to disability access. Because I'm wondering also, I mean, one of the questions, I think the emphasis on thinking the lower body and of movement is vital, but I'm also at times wary of a different longstanding trope in which non-physical motility equals passivity. There's a certain way in which, like around spectatorship, for instance, there's been, I think, really important critiques of the idea that to watch something is therefore to kind of have no agency within it. So I would, yeah, I guess I would just, it's an open question, but I was struck by thinking about the at times radical, at times not radical enough remaking of educational architectures in terms of different forms of access. Yeah. You know, long question.
This.
So thank you very much for your presentations. I was, while you two were presenting, there were a few, one question that came to my mind was the connection between walking and barricade. And I was thinking in a moment where, for example, in the US with the Brown versus Board of Education, where walking or a black person walking to school was faced with a barricade of human bodies. Do not allow them to get to go to school, to get in the school structure. So I'm wondering if this walking and you researching on walking and you researching on barricades, if you are taking in consideration these moments of history that walking is not just out of school but to school, but it faces with a barricade.
Yeah, we should all three get together and write it.
The short answer would be, because there's many ways, but I would say in terms of also some of the history I was gesturing towards the end, and I know you've been also working on, but thinking about the expanded programs of the Panthers, for instance, there's a very, also a different, a defense of the right to walk in public space, particularly in terms of the capacity to kind of police the police. So that's my one thought, is that would be a kind of way into that, to in some sense insist upon the... or to insist upon a refusal of a certain kind of distance in which police alone have the legitimate right to approach however close they want, which is one that doesn't go to someone else. I think that remains one of the most startlingly radical tactics and moments in American 20th century history. So that's, I think, would be one thing that's been coming to mind in some sense, of the refusal of that prescribed but variable distance.
Yes, I mean, I'd have a lot of additional questions, but I keep myself, I hold myself back. Closing remarks, wrapping up trying to wrap up these 2 days, this would be rather impossible, or you would need, I don't know, someone like Kodjo Esho to do it. So I'd rather like to simply thank the two of you, and to thank everyone who has been talking during these days, who's been presenting, especially. And I would also like to thank, because I've thanked the Huckabee team and everyone who has been instrumental in the production of this event, but I would also like to mention in particular Junia Tiede and Sophia Rohwetter for their assistance throughout the 2 days. And I would also like to thank Simon Franskowiak and Andreas Buchholz from Serviu, who have been just to name a few names. There are others that could have been named, which I don't have the names right now, but I'm also thanking you. Thank you very much for being, for recording this event throughout the days. I would like to thank the interpreters who translated the first session yesterday, and I would like to thank you who have been so patient and interested and throughout these days. It was really quite rewarding, I have to say. So thank you, and we are all looking forward to meeting you again at the latest in September next year during the opening days for Exit for Education Shock. Thank you very much.